Shutdown, day 33. Across the country, the lack of federal funding has affected government employees, Native communities, Americans relying on food stamps, and more. And the next victims of the month-long crisis could be Americans suffering from opioid addiction as the money that funds treatment programs across the country dries up. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today on The Takeaway. Every day in the United States, 130 Americans die from an opioid overdose. In fact, according to the National Safety Council, Americans are now more likely to die of an opioid overdose than in a car crash. Efforts to fight opioid addiction vary widely by state, but federal dollars are critical to many of the programs that directly help people suffering from opioid addiction.
Any program that was using federal grant money or federal money has the potential that that money is not going to get to them right now.
Tom Sinan is the police chief for the village of Newtown, Ohio, and a member of the Hamilton County Heroin Coalition. For his community, a lack of federal dollars during the shutdown hits on-the-ground efforts the hardest.
For us in Hamilton County, it really impacts our quick response team, which is a police officer, firefighter, and addiction specialist that are going out and going door to door after someone overdoses and try to connect them to treatment.
But the term quick response doesn't really give the full picture here. Chief Sinan says this program can often save lives in the long term.
What they are finding is sometimes after, even if someone doesn't get into treatment, a few weeks later they may reach out to them and say, I want help. It gives them literature, it gives them education, it gives them a connection to get that treatment. And when that is stalled, that's people we're not able to go out and make contact with and be able to try to interdict with and try to be able to help.
And stalled is exactly where many programs like this will be, as federal funding is set to disappear.
When you're talking about this epidemic, one of the things that it really holds us back is the up in the air. That's what we faced before we started getting these programs and before the government got involved, the federal government. And now with the government shutdown, it starts adding those questions of what will happen next? Will the money be there? Will the funding be there? What do we do with this program and how do we pay for it? How do we keep it going?
That sense of uncertainty carries over state lines. Head from Ohio to Pennsylvania, for example, and the shutdown's impact on the crisis is visible in other ways. Take Philadelphia.
Housing is a big part of trying to solve the opioid crisis or trying to alleviate the opioid crisis in Philadelphia.
Aubrey Whalen is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer covering the opioid epidemic.
You know, there's a lot of street homelessness here that's directly related to opioid addiction. So a lot of the efforts around kind of getting people well and getting people treatment have also been centered around getting them inside.
And now the shutdown is making those housing efforts much more difficult. That's playing out in one eagerly anticipated and now stalled neighborhood project.
Project Home is a housing poverty and homeless services organization in Philadelphia. It's been around for a really long time. And it is building housing for people, 42 units of housing for people who are recovering from addiction. It's in Kensington, which is one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in the city by the opioid crisis. It has a lot of homelessness, a lot of addiction. They had sort of a groundbreaking last week and mentioned at the very end that they were actually unable to begin construction because they were waiting on paperwork from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is shut down.
Without critical federal funding, the project is on indefinite hold. But Whalen says Project Home is not the only Philadelphia housing program facing hurdles because of the shutdown.
Another is Pathways to Housing, which is a housing first organization, which is a little bit more unusual. They take people who are still in active addiction. They don't require you to be sober. They just give you a house and connect you to services. And the idea is that the stability of a home makes it a lot easier for people to get into recovery. And that's seemed to be the case for a lot of their participants. So Pathways, for example, is also funded by HUD. And their director says that, on February 1st, they're going to need about $100,000 a month to keep participants in their homes.
There are people who are going to lose their homes in the shutdown. And if they've been in a long-term recovery, this is the kind of thing that may cause them to relapse.
Jeff Bratberg is a clinical professor of pharmacy practice at the University of Rhode Island. And he says the shutdown could also affect funding for the overdose reversal drug naloxone, or Narcan.
There was a giant package of opioid overdose crisis-related bills called the H.R. 6, or the Support Act, that was signed into law before the shutdown. So any of those portions of the act, there are segments of the federal government, they need to implement that. And there is significant naloxone funding in part of some of those bills, and so that will be delayed.
But Bratberg says even where Narcan remains available, in times of economic hardship, people may not be willing or even able to buy it.
Some of those hundreds of thousands of federal employees that may want to acquire naloxone, if their copay is too high or if their insurance doesn't cover naloxone, obviously they're going to be making choices between paying rent or getting heat. Yes, they have insurance, but they may not be able to afford their copay. So people are going to be making choices like that.
Ryan Hampton has been tracking the national picture of what the shutdown means for the response to the opioid epidemic. He's a recovery activist and the author of American Fix: Inside the Opioid Addiction Crisis and How to End It. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
What is the federal picture? What about in D.C. right now? How is the shutdown impacting efforts there?
I'd like to say just because the government shuts down, first of all, it doesn't mean that drug cravings, opioid cravings just stop. I mean, we're having a huge problem with DEA waivers getting through in a timely fashion. I have treatment centers that are calling me anywhere from Texas to Mississippi to Arkansas to New Jersey out here in California who aren't able to treat patients. Treatment centers that have the ability to have the capacity of hundreds and hundreds of patients that are addicted to opioids and need help, they can't get the waivers they need so that they can use life-saving medications such as methadone or buprenorphine. And, you know, on that note, also because the government shuts down does not mean that drug dealers shut down as well. In the last 24 hours, I'm hearing from members of the FBI task force, different drug task force around the country, who aren't able to really do their job. Their efforts are being hampered because a lot of their work relies on confidential informants, folks that lead them up the chain to cartels and larger drug dealers, and they don't have the funds available to be able to pay those confidential informants. Those folks rely on paying their sources, and that money has pretty much dried up, and they're at risk of losing those sources, not just during the shutdown, but forever. You know, it's kind of ironic that the president's using opioids once again as a political football for his wall, and the need, you know, to have this wall to stop the opioids from flowing into the country, as he says. But in the meantime, we're basically going to stop treating people. We're going to hamper law enforcement. And essentially, you know, at the end of the road, some people will die. And I don't think that folks really understand how interconnected seemingly distant impacts actually are when it comes to this crisis.
You mentioned getting the necessary waivers. Is that because, what's the holdup there? Why can't clinicians get those waivers?
Funding for the DEA has been slowed down. Now, it was, you know, at the beginning it was halted. Those offices have opened back up, but they're already huge waiting lists to get these waivers. And, you know, when the system's open for business, it's already incredibly inefficient. So this shutdown has only slowed that process up. It's actually slowed it up at a rate that's really unacceptable. You just can't say that you're serious about ending the opioid crisis and then essentially turning off these critical services in the middle of a political stunt. It's just unacceptable.
The Support Act, as it's known, or H.R. 6, was a law that was signed last year. Remind us what that was supposed to do and how that's being impacted by the shutdown.
Sure. H.R. 6, you know, was providing new block grant money, programs that were supposed to be made available for treatment, recovery supports, research, housing, employment, all critical services to helping find people help, leading them on the pathway to wellness, but also into sustained recovery. Majority of that money is coming through different federal departments, whether it be HHS or HUD. As we know, a lot of those divisions, departments, federal agencies are closed as a result of the shutdown, and that money is being held up. I'm talking to state drug directors, state directors of mental health and substance abuse divisions, and they can't get access to the money. Now, some of this money is running, you know, for another month or two, but there's just all this ambiguity over the new grant money, whether or not they're going to get it. And I think, you know, particularly one thing that does get lost in this conversation is we have children. We have kids who are also orphaned by parents who have died from overdoses, or parents who suffer from substance use disorder, who are being cared by people and organizations who receive much needed support from the federal government. And those caregivers and organizations are terrified just looking 1, 2, 3 weeks into the distance. They don't know what's going to happen. Transportation, Department of Transportation, is another big issue. We have people who are in recovery from addiction, in recovery from opioids, who rely on federally funded public transportation to get to outpatient support every morning. There's a young lady in New Hampshire who's been blowing up my phone and bringing this to my attention that she can't get to her treatment programs, her outpatient treatment programs, because there's no funding for her transportation right now. So all these issues are really interconnected, and it's taking a huge impact on addressing this crisis.
I'm just curious, Ryan, in terms of what was done prior to the shutdown, was that sufficient? I mean, have you seen other real efforts made to combat this crisis?
We were making progress. I mean, we were definitely on the right trajectory. The system was still incredibly inefficient, though. I mean, when we are open for business, we don't have enough services. We don't have enough recovery support services. There's not enough money that's going into treatment. There's, you know, not enough money that's going into research, which is something that has also been impacted by this shutdown prevention. So the system was already broken, but we were on the right trajectory with HR 6. And now all that good work has just come to a halt, and people really are terrified. You know, one thing that also gets lost in the discussion and conversation are the harm reduction efforts, federally funded needle exchange programs, which have essentially come to a stop right now, a standstill, until the government figures out what to do.
Ryan Hampton is the author of American Fix: Inside the Opioid Addiction Crisis and How to End It. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage and banners. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples.
By Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photos directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fracturemead.com/takeaway.
And Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
Since 2016, the city of Newark, New Jersey, has been grappling with a growing crisis around the city's aging infrastructure, its drinking water, and elevated levels of lead. An October 2018 study found that a corrosion control system at one of the city's two sources had failed. On Tuesday's show, we talked with Star Ledger reporter Karen Yee about the cause of Newark's tainted water.
So essentially, the water going through the pipes was corrosive, and it was causing the lead in these old pipes to leach into the water and then go through the faucet.
Earlier this month, another round of tests showed that lead levels in the city's water to be the highest they've been in 17 years. Now, Newark Mayor Roz Baraka is calling on the federal government for help. Last week, he wrote an open letter to President Trump asking for help and calling the situation a national crisis. For more, I'm joined now in the studio by Mayor Roz Baraka. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the reporting around the water crisis in Newark has given us a picture of basically this, as we mentioned, aging infrastructure, failed corrosion control. But in terms of the messaging to your constituents, there were many different messages here. One of them was pretty clear, that there was no issue with the water. Are you confident that you were clear to your residents about the problem?
Absolutely. We never told them there was no issue with the water. We said it was no issue with our system with the drinking water, period. You know, so the argument was, and I even heard the reporter make a little mistake. She said the water was coming in corrosive, and that's not correct, right? So there was nothing wrong with it. There was nothing wrong with the water in our source. The problem is that we have lead pipes, and we have to make that clear because there has to be a fix on the lead pipes, right? So the problem with the lead pipes is that the lead seeps from the pipes and gets into the water. We put a corrosion control inhibitor in the water to kind of coat the pipe so the pipe's lead will not leach into the water. When that inhibitor ceases to work, then lead gets from the pipe into the water. But ultimately, the ultimate fix is to change the pipes altogether. The problem with that is the pipe belongs to the residents. So we have to find a way to fix these pipes collectively, a public-private kind of a partnership to get this done, and we've begun that.
So, Mayor, I'm just curious. In April 2018, your office sent out a robocall to residents that said, "This is Mayor Baraka. The city's water is not contaminated with lead." If I heard that, I would take your word for it, that the city's water is not contaminated with lead. So there seems to be a discrepancy there.
No, you should listen to the entire.
Okay, so tell me. Yes, because I don't have it. So tell me.
So it said that that Newark's water is fine, that the problem is with homes that have lead pipes. That's what it said. So if you do not have a lead pipe, then you don't have a problem. So there are about 15,000 to 20,000 homes in Newark, hundreds of thousands across the state of New Jersey, millions across the country that have lead service lines that need to be replaced. And so the message was clearly, if you have a lead service line, then you have an issue and it needs to be replaced. And that's the message that we were putting out to people. And we consistently put that message out, which is why we're asking the state and the federal government to help us to replace people's lead service lines.
So I want to have one more voice in here about this issue, Mayor Baraka. Back in November, we had on the Brian Lehrer Show, our friends right next door here on WNYC had covered this issue, and they had a Newark resident named Sammy, who right. called into the show. So I want to play you what Sammy had to say.
I'm a federal employee. I work in the federal building, and I got this job about 3 years ago. And back then, when I was interviewing for the job, they told me never drink Newark water. We've always had a water club. And about a year ago, they tested the levels in our building and said that they were dangerous, and they started providing free water for us. So we haven't had to pay for that. GSA provides that. And I was stunned to see that this is just hitting the news now.
Mayor, what's your response to that?
Well, I don't know where she get that information from. Our water is tested by us, by the DEP, the EPA. That's how we even found out the corrosion control inhibitor wasn't working. Newark has some of the best water in the state, the country even, which is what the argument was in the beginning. Comments like that, Newark's water is bad, which is not true, right? We supply the entire northern state of New Jersey with water, right? So Newark has great water. We sell it to other municipalities. The problem has always been lead service lines. And big buildings don't even have lead service lines. I don't know what they have in the building. Like maybe they have lead fixtures or, you know, that would cause that if the lead leached into the water from that. But our water is fine unless it goes through a fixture that is made with lead.
Well, there's obviously a problem with the water, Mayor, because now you have reached out to the president.
Right.
You wrote an open letter to President Trump. You're saying that this is a crisis. What is
it
the
is crisis? A crisis?
So tell us what the crisis is if there's no lead
the
in the water.
The crisis is, as we started in the beginning, the crisis is the infrastructure. There is a infrastructure problem that we have in this city that 22 different municipalities have in the state of New Jersey, you know, that 11 different counties have in the state of New Jersey, that 10 million residents across the nation have, which is lead service lines, lead fixtures. The infrastructure must be changed. That is a different kind of, you know, context is saying the water itself is bad. The water becomes bad when lead leaches into the water from pipes that are that needs to be changed. Where you know that
so
needs
let me
to
ask,
be put out.
So, Mayor, what are you asking for from the federal government, which, as you know, is partly or mostly shut down right now? What are you asking for to fix this problem? Because we understand that Newark residents have also been given filters if they need them to filter their own.
30,000 filters we've been given out.
30,000.
But we want to change the lead service lines.
So where does the president come in that?
Well, the state has already given us some money. The city has bonded money. It's going to cost the city $75 million, the state of New Jersey, hundreds of millions of dollars. The Senator Booker and Congressman Pallone have been working on a fix to get additional money for us from the federal government. We can't get that money because the state is shut down. Besides that, they're arguing over $5 billion that we could use for this problem. Not only Newark, we could use it across the state of New Jersey and other municipalities across the country. 10 million customers across the country can use the lead service fix.
So, Mayor, so ultimately, what are you hoping? You said there's a $5 billion, obviously, that's being negotiated or fought over, if you will, in D.C. right now. What's the most immediate thing that can happen for these residents of Newark in lieu of getting federal funding, which right now seems to be held up without any end?
Well, we've already gotten funding from the state and the local government, so the city. We're going to replace about 1,500 lead service lines beginning in March. Obviously, we're going to run out of money, and we have 20,000 or anywhere between 15 and 20,000 lines to fix. We're going to need additional support. We're going to need additional state support. And if the state is going to fix, you know, all of the pipes across the entire state, they're going to need a lot more money than the money that they're using to help us fix Newark. So we need federal dollars to do this.
Now, we know that this is a problem also of Newark's infrastructure. It's old. I'm wondering, though, when we think about lead in water and when we think about lead in paint, for example, these are environmental factors that often tend to impact communities of color and poor communities. When you look across the state of New Jersey, are there other, you mentioned there are other parts of the state that need this type of help. Are those also similar in their demographic profile?
Many of them, and some of them are rural communities as well, right, that use wells and other kinds of things. So you're talking about 22 different cities and 11 different counties that have this problem. Many of them are black and brown communities. Some of them are kind of poorer rural communities. But, yeah, I mean, so we are three times more likely to have, to be affected by this kind of lead crisis than anybody else.
One of the things also that pivoting from the lead crisis here for a second and to the bigger issues surrounding Newark, has been talked about for a while, or at least your administration has been trying to make it bring some sort of revitalization to the community. What does that look like today?
Well, it's still,
it was supposed to be a tech hub. You guys were trying for Amazon. None of that happened.
We're still a tech hub.
Okay, so tell me how that happened.
Newark is still, we have 27 miles of fiber, which is why Amazon wanted to come there in Newark that we owned. We just launched, Link Newark, New York, London, and Newark are the only three cities that have that. You know, we offer free Wi-Fi in parks and recreation centers, and we have many startup tech companies. We have a tech incubator in the city where Audible, which is a subsidiary of Amazon, exists, and they're expanding in our city. So we have Panasonic that have come there, Mars. Confectionery is coming to Newark. So those things are happening. You know, Amazon was a way for us to continue to advertise the good things that were happening in our city. We feel like we won anyway. To get the actual company would have been gravy. We won when we got on the top five list.
Are Newark residents benefiting from any of these jobs? I think it's about 20% of Newark residents that are actually employed by these jobs.
No, the number was 18%, and that's been, that's a number where the anchor institutions, not these jobs like new jobs, just anchor institutions, that is something that has historically been an issue in our city. We have something called Newark 2020 that is driving that number down. In fact, unemployment in the city of Newark is at a two or three decade low at this point. So Newark residents are being employed by folks that come into the city. In fact, it's a mandate that if you come in Newark, you have to employ Newark residents.
There it is. Newark Mayor Roz Baraka, thank you again for joining us.
You're very welcome.
On Tuesday, the 2019 Academy Award nominations were announced, and the field included some notable milestones. Yalitza Aparicio, the star of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, became the first indigenous woman to ever be nominated for Best Actress. Black Panther earned the first Best Picture nomination for a superhero movie. And more than three decades into his career, Spike Lee finally got his first Best Director nod for Black Klansman. Green Book also had a good Tuesday, earning 5 nominations, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Original Screenplay. The film is based on the true story of Dr. Don Shirley, an accomplished black pianist who rode through the Deep South in 1962 with a white driver, Tony Vallelonga.
Dear Dolores, D-E-A-R, this is an animal. As I'm writing this letter, I'm eating potato chips, and I'm starting to get thirsty. You know this is pathetic, right? Tell me what you're trying to say.
I don't know. Yeah, I'll miss her.
Then say that. But do it in a manner that no one else has ever done it before.
It's the type of film that Oscars voters typically love to honor, but the film has also been mired in controversy, particularly about its historical accuracy and what some critics are calling a feel-good approach to race relations. For more on the film, I'm joined now by two critics. Rafer Guzman is our film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Welcome, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Cameron Collins is a film critic for Vanity Fair. Welcome to the show, Cameron.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's get started on these light topics, race and movies. Rafer, for those who haven't seen the film. I mean, a little bit about the story here. The Green Book itself, right, was a tool for Black Americans to use to stay safe when they were traveling. There is a historical lack, I think, in the film, right? So, Rafer, can you sort of talk us through that?
I think Green Book was really just a good name. I think it's a good title for the film. It kind of hooks you and gets you in. It gives you a little bit of, once you know what it is, it gives you a little bit of sense of history, you know, this idea that African Americans at the time had to use this book to find out where they could and could not stay, where they could get a drink, where they could sleep, etc. That's interesting, and it evokes the time and it evokes the place pretty well. It doesn't really figure into the story almost at all. There may be one or two scenes, I think, where you can see them flipping through the Green Book, and that's really about it. It's really mostly about the story of Don Shirley, the musician, and Tony Lip, as he's called, the driver.
Cameron, why? Because that seems to be one of the biggest critiques of the film, among many, was that it did not focus on the heaviness, the sort of historical importance of the Green Book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of an implicit part of the story insofar as you assume that every sort of motel that they stay at is a Green Book approved place. This is sort of it's sort of like a, I don't want to call it like a black Yelp, but it is a sort of a way of keeping track. Just, I mean, you know, Jim Crow laws, even after they ended, the mentality persisted. So you definitely have a black character who is very aware of that. This is why he hires a sort of, you know, a bouncer from the Copacabana to drive him through sundown towns, these places where after dark you just as an African American do not want to be, which still exist. It's implicit, but it's not really a factor in the story, I don't think.
Rafer, what about the people who were behind the film? Apparently, it's the real-life son of Tony Vallelonga, who is the driver, right?
That's right, Nick Vallelonga, his son, who wrote this story because, and again, there's been a little controversy about this, but he felt that this was a really formative experience for his father and that afterwards, his father and Don Shirley, the musician, had been lifelong friends. And Don Shirley's family has come out and said that's not true, although I think there are others that have testified to that. There's a documentary, I think, on this subject, and others have said that they were. That's a little bit, I guess, up in the air. You know, who knows what lifelong friend, dear friend, I don't know. But they seem to have maintained a connection. They seem to certainly have been through something. And then, of course, as people may or may not know, it's Peter Farrelly, who's one of the co-writers and one of the directors, the guy behind Dumb and Dumber and Kingpin. So a real surprise. And a real surprise, I think, for him to, have done this film, his first sort of real heartfelt kind of issues-based drama that I don't think anyone expected of him, and then for the Oscars to respond so well to it. They really love this film.
Cameron, but who else is responding to this film? Because I keep thinking about Dr. Shirley's family.
Right.
Have they, you know, weighed in on the historical accuracy or lack thereof of the film?
They have in multiple interviews, including a great piece at IndieWire. People have been reaching out to them ever since. I mean, I have to say, when I first saw the movie, did not know that Nick Vallelonga was one of the writers. When I found that out, something clicked about the movie. But after the movie came out and more people were talking about this issue, the Shirley family has been a bit more open and a bit more open about, you know, going to screenings, whether or not they were invited, whether or not anyone talked to them. what resources could possibly have been used. And Nick Villalonga's story is that he did speak with Dr. Shirley, and Dr. Shirley had sort of caveats about what he wanted. He didn't want this movie made until after he died, for example. And so it's, you know, for me, it's not even just a matter of accuracy. I think my takeaway is that whatever the relationship was between these two men, it is much more interesting than that movie.
It's also coming at a time where we're seeing, as we mentioned at the top, Spike Lee is getting his first director nom for Black Klansman. Black Panther is out there. I mean, the Oscars are still relatively pretty white. Rafer, you mentioned that the film Green Book gave you a sense that it was a very straightforward sort of take on race relations in many ways. And Cameron, you've written about the first film that comes to mind is Driving Miss Daisy when you think about this. Tell us a little bit about the reaction to Driving Miss Daisy winning the Oscar, I suppose. And then we could take it from there on your great piece.
Well, it's interesting because these things are so difficult to measure, in part because Driving Miss Daisy and Do the Right Thing, which came out the same year, came out at a much different moment for the Oscars. This is something that I discovered in my reporting for this piece, just that, you know, this is pre-screeners. This was an era when if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to a screening if you were in the Academy, that the movie's not going to come to you. And when you think of it in those practical terms, the sorts of choices that people make about which movies to see become more complicated because, for example, my impression, and I'm getting this partially from Mark Harris, the great film historian and film writer, is that, for example, with Do the Right Thing, you have it come out at Cannes, come out at the Cannes Film Festival, and already there you have people writing pieces suggesting that it could cause riots. Right. And this is pre-LA riot. Right. This is like a before really everything came to a head. But so when you think about that and you think about the multiple pieces that were written in New York Magazine about the movie, both from Joe Klein and the film critic David Denby, that also suggested that there was political implications here that were in some way sort of racially dangerous. You think about that and then you think about the Academy voter who has to go from those to go see the movie. I think to answer your question more directly, the response to Driving Miss Daisy winning really depends on who you ask. I think among younger Academy members and certainly among the Black public, it's an embarrassment. It is wild to watch these films back to back and to realize that they were made in the same year, even just aesthetically in terms of style, in terms of acting, in terms of vision. It is remarkable to watch them back and back and say, wow, this was 1989.
I also want to get your take on this idea of the white savior film, right? The white savior character in film. These films today can feel sort of lacking, right? We've come so far. And when you look at a film like Black Klansman, whether you liked it or didn't like it, I still think it took the conversation a little further.
Yeah, audiences of color are fed up with this because it is the predominant narrative, particularly for actors of color. If you think about the great actors of color throughout history, generally when they were employed, for example, if you were a Black woman, you were going to be a maid. If you were a Black character in a sort of buddy movie, like as Sidney Poitier was for too many movies, and he felt so as well, you were going to play the kind of role that Mahershala Ali plays in Green Book. I will say in Green Book's favor that what's interesting – and I think what should have been used more is the class difference, which also comes up in other, you know, in Driving Miss Daisy, you have a rich Southern white woman and her driver. There's a steep class difference there. And in Green Book, you have the Black person as the rich character, the literate character, the one with the apartment over Carnegie Hall. And things like that are just like, I don't need him to be the main character of the movie. I appreciate someone wanted to take their father's stories and turn them into a movie. I have no qualms about that. And I have no qualms about Tony Lip being a sort of interesting side character who gets his own movie. I think this, you know, in terms of movies, the side characters are often the most interesting people. But why did this have to be a sort of mutual betterment? I'm going to make you feel better about your Blackness. You're going to be caught doing something homosexual and I'm not going to care somehow. you know, things like that. It doesn't add up. And I think for a Black audience member, for audience members of color broadly, just we are so tired of that.
Let's pivot for a minute here because Cameron, you did bring up a good point. There was some breaking news today in the film world. Bohemian Rhapsody, the film about Freddie Mercury, also got 5 Oscar nominations, and that was also a contentious production, if you will.
Yes.
Bryan Singer, the movie's director, who was fired midway through the production. It's reported today that there are allegations of sexual assault by 4 men who were all underage at the time. I would love to hear both of your reactions to this news and whether or not what impact this could have or not on a film that's Oscar seemed to love, but audiences seem to be mixed on.
I would actually say sort of the opposite. Although the Bohemian Rhapsody, the funny thing about this movie is that it has been critically panned, not unanimously, but the bad reviews have been so bad that I think they have overshadowed the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody has actually played really well with audiences.
Really?
I think it got an A cinema score. It has done very well overseas. That thing has been a success.
It really has.
And while nobody was looking, you know, that's why it stole the Golden Globe. You know, none of us were paying attention, really, myself included. And so much so that nobody was really talking about the fact that there have been simmering allegations about Bryan Singer for a very, very long time.
I have to say, between Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody, I'm actually a bit more upset about Bohemian Rhapsody being nominated because I think about it in the context of Me Too. I think that male victims are seeing the nomination of this movie and perhaps rightly thinking, you know, if this had happened in the context of, you know, the women victims that we've been talking about in relationship to the Me Too movement, everyone would have known better. I think
known it, better to what?
Known better than to sort of put Bohemian Rhapsody on a ballot. Because I think, you know, it doesn't matter that no trial has happened. It matters that these allegations have been brewing for many years.
Yep.
And BuzzFeed has done pieces on it. In addition to sort of all the rumors in Hollywood that I'm sure people have been hearing about. This is an open secret. I have friends who only recently entered the industry who already have come into contact with some Singer associates and have already said that they're being sexually harassed. Things like this are just open secrets to me. So it is very disappointing to think that that was not a part of people's calculus. You know, Green Book is just a matter of taste and a matter of politics too, but Bohemian Rhapsody, I really think it's embarrassing. And I think the more that these Singer allegations come out, the more articles that are being written, it's going to look even more embarrassing. It really is really a shameful, I think, thing, frankly.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Cameron Collins, film critic for Vanity Fair. Thank you both for joining us for this fantastic conversation.
Thanks, Tanzina.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.